Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. And my guest today is Rabbi Sherry Kohler-Fox. And she is the president of New Cage and has been the chair of the New Cage conferences from 2010 to 2016. And the reason that I wanted to bring her on to the episode, to the podcast, was talking both about the work of the organization and about the process of rebranding from Cage to New Cage and what that means for the organization and for Jewish education as a whole. Welcome to the podcast, Sherry. I'd love for you to just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about the work of the organization that you're the president of.
So New Cage is an important aspect of Jewish education in the United States. I founded CAGE when I was in my 20s, along with some friends of mine, because we were coming into the field and we looked around and we didn't see a field. And that was troubling because we were creative and we were innovative. And our goal was not just to make a better school, it was to really change the way Jewish education was being delivered, let's say, in the United States and beyond. And there was no way to do that without having some way to share information with your friends. And this was long before the internet. So we developed CAGE as a grassroots organization.
And remind us, what does it stand for?
Well, CAGE went through a number of iterations of what it stands for. We called it at first the Conference on Alternatives in Jewish Education, meaning there were many alternatives and you should know them and be able to choose which ones were important to you. Mm-hmm. And then it became the Coalition for Alternatives in Jewish Education. And then it became the Coalition for the Advancement of Jewish Education because apparently the word alternative was 270s.
Okay.
For people.
So ways that the organization has evolved over right. time. Wonderful.
So now New Cage doesn't mean anything, I guess, except that it's new because we felt that a new generation of leaders could call it whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. They could either decide what the letters meant or they could find a new name for it. In 2008, CAGE went bankrupt for a variety of reasons, and the founders of CAGE, who hadn't been on the board during that process, talked about whether it was okay to let CAGE die or if there was something intrinsically important about CAGE for Jewish education, and we decided the latter. Mm-hmm. We decided Jewish education would not be better off without an organization that created a field.
Are there other organizations that bring Jewish educators across denominations the way that you do?
No.
No. And so the programs that you currently have, you have an annual conference and that you've been doing for a number of years.
This year is going to be our 8th year.
Oh, fantastic.
And CAGE, I believe, had 34 conferences.
Okay. So this will be your 8th consecutive year.
Our 8th consecutive year.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about yourself. How did you come to founding an organization? And is this what you've been doing ever since?
There was a group of us at Harvard. It's a terrible way to start a story. There were a group of us at Harvard, but that's how it started. Mm-hmm. And we were in a department called Learning Environments. And there were a half a dozen Jews in that department, but there were also a half a dozen Native Americans and a half a dozen Puerto Ricans. So this was like an ethnic, different ethnic groups trying to learn how to bring their ethnic heritage to their own people. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the charge of what was going on there. And I think we were a little surprised, the Jews, I mean, to find ourselves in a department like this. Maybe at that time, it was the early 70s, but we learned a lot from the Native Americans, especially, where these people really wanted to save their language and they wanted to save their customs, and their people were running away from that. And they were leaving the reservations and they were going into town. And I'm sure you know that in town, they found liquor, and liquor, it turns out, is not a good match with Native American physiology.
Right.
So these young people were fighting for their heritage. And we looked at each other and we realized that basically we were doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. The funny answer to the question of had we founded organizations before, the answer is yes. That we had been involved in youth groups. We had been involved in Network, which was connected to WGIS, which was an international organization. We've been founding organizations or being a part of organizations our whole teenage life until then. And so this modality was kind of one that we were used to as a group. Yes.
And so was there a particular person or a particular moment in your career as you look back that was particularly influential in your work or something that stands out to you?
So I was running a school in Belmont, Massachusetts at a synagogue, and we had come to understand open classroom. Mm-hmm. And when we walked into an open classroom, we didn't see what the secular open classroom saw. What we saw there was a society, a community, and it immediately felt to us like a shtetl.
Yeah.
You know, it felt authentic to us. So I built an open classroom in Belmont, and we had, you know, individualized Hebrew, and we had a whole like Beit Midrash kind of set up, and we had a theater and we had art supplies. And what we were trying to do was create like a real Jewish community there, not just let's learn Hebrew, but let's create a whole Jewish world in this. So my board came in and they said, oh, well, we either have the best school in the United States or we have the worst school in the United States. And honestly, we don't know which one it is. And that was kind of an impetus for me because I thought there ought to be a place where you could go to find out whether you had the best school or the worst school.
Right.
Like, why should an individual board have to ask that question? And by the way, now that I say it out loud, that's really an ongoing question about the relationship between synagogue boards and the schools that they're running.
Right.
That's a complicated question.
They
can be very disconnected.
And so is that something that you've explored through your work with CAGE and your conferences and things that people come to you and talked about this issue?
This is a question that always gets discussed, but one of the things that I started doing at CAGE, beginning from the beginning, but it took me 25 years. It's kind of pathetic. It took me 25 years working with CAGE to get them to have an advocacy commission. But now, as part of New CAGE, we also are working on advocacy. And advocacy is the place, is one of the places where it's really important to have this discussion.
As far as how to advocate for the things that your school needs.
How to advocate for what your school needs and how to advocate for what you need and how to advocate for what Jewish education needs.
That's great. And have you found that because your work crosses so many denominations and is, you know, an open platform, is that beneficial? Is it sometimes difficult to have those conversations, maybe feeling a little disconnected? Is it, tell me a little bit about that experience of trying to cross all those, seemingly at some points feeling like great divides.
You know, this is one thing that everybody shares in common. Yeah. They could be a preschool, they could be a cantor, they could be, you know, a religious school, they could be a day school, and there's still this divide between the boards and the professionals. Mm-hmm. And in fact, right now, we're doing a study about excellence in Jewish education, what makes excellence. We've just started it. But one of the things we've seen in the first 25 or 30 interviews is excellent schools have excellent boards, and they work together excellently. And when you don't have that, everything suffers.
And how do the rabbis factor into those conversations about board?
The synagogue rabbis?
I mean, are they advocates for the school? Are they advocates on the board? Are they staying out of the conversations?
You're going to get me in trouble.
Oh, no, no, no.
As you know, I wear both of those hats.
Yeah.
And one of the best
perspective.
Yes, and one of the best things for me was that when I was running a school, the principal and the rabbi always agreed with each other. But if you want to know politically how a synagogue works, the rabbi cares about the school deeply, but never gets into a fight with the board about a school.
Right.
Doesn't help him very much, or her. Mm-hmm. You know, I said never. I'm sure there's some progressive rabbis out there that would put their job on the line for the school, but.
But generally, it's the idea that we've hired a director and that's their job, and my job is a different purview than the school.
No, not that. I'm talking about politically. Like, if we need more money for the school, or there's some issue between the board and the principal, the rabbi often stays out of it. Now, yeah. I can tell you cases where that was not the case, and I'm very proud of these rabbis, but there's one school that uses a Bible curriculum that I have written with my husband, and that curriculum teaches text from beginning to end. It doesn't skip anything. Mm-hmm. So very early in this process, you come to Cain and Abel, which is about murder, I suppose. You could look at it that way. And there's always some parent that comes to the board. This is actually a good example of the board, you know, issues, but comes to the board and said, why are you teaching my child about murder? Hmm. At that point, if the curriculum is going to continue successfully in the school, the rabbi has to say, well, it's in the Bible and we're a Jewish school and that's what we do. And when that family leaves the community, he has to be able to let them go and not have the board not be supportive of that. You can see the triangle there.
Yeah, you have an interesting dynamic that a lot of other organizations don't have, where your lay leaders and your board members making decisions are integrally connected, especially to the school, with the interest of their own children.
And, right, exactly.
And that can get messy. Yeah.
Yes. And by the way, this story isn't about murder.
Right. Yeah, well, parents will always think whatever they'd like to about what.
Exactly.
What's the advice that you give to educators that happen to be dealing with these types of issues?
Well, I think that we are not ready to give advice about this. Mm. I think that when I came to a school to work, I told my board that they hired me because I had an expertise. Mm-hmm. And that curriculum, for example, was my job. And if they didn't think I was going in the right direction with curriculum, that they should ask me to leave.
Right.
That I would consult with them whenever there was an issue or a problem, but that ultimately curriculum was not their job. Mm-hmm. And this is, probably 70-30, 50-50, this is how it works. So if a board is determining curriculum in a school, that's not good. And if a school is not talking to their lay people and knowing what they want, if they're ignoring the needs of their own community, that's not good. So there has to be a rapprochement, or there has to be a cooperation mm-hmm. between them. But the expertise is not with lay leaders about should we teach Holocaust or shouldn't we teach Holocaust, which was the discussion I walked into on the first day that I met with that school committee.
Right. And is this an issue that you've seen that's been, you know, perpetuated over the years? This is a newer issue?
This is not a new issue.
Yeah.
And if I was talking about being a rabbi, we could have the same discussion.
Right.
In other words, what is the role of lay leadership? It's critical because it is their congregation. Mm-hmm. It is not your congregation. It is
right. They pay your salary, which makes yes. it even harder. Yeah.
Right. There are employers, which often they don't know, which is why issues of professional development, issues of salary, issue of benefits often don't resonate with the board because they don't understand that they're your employers on some level. And on the other hand, they do understand that they're the keeper of the budget. They have the responsibility for the budget of the congregation. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, well, the principal should be able to go to the school and say, we need this many teachers, we need this expertise of teachers, it's going to cost this much. And the board, in theory, ought to make that happen mm-hmm. for the benefit of the school. But what happens is that the board will say, well, we have this much money, so make it work.
Right.
And I'm not saying that I think there's an infinite amount of money. I understand that. But the question of excellence in schools doesn't come into play in this discussion. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I had a principal tell me the other day that she had this vision of full-time teachers for her Hebrew school. Because there is no question that if you want excellence in a school, you need full-time teachers. You need to be there during the day to collaborate, to prepare, to
talk.
This
is for a day school?
No, this is for a Hebrew school.
Oh, for a Hebrew school, okay.
A Hebrew school, 6 hours a week for each group of kids. And yet, if you really want to have an excellent, deep, important program, you need some, you don't need all, but you need some full-time teachers. So there are some schools in New York City that hire 6 full-time teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted 3 full-time teachers for her school. And the board agreed, but said the bottom line had to stay the same.
Okay.
So she stood on her head and moved everything around so she could have what she considered to be an important way to get to the best school.
Mm-hmm.
So the process is wrong. It should be, what is the value to our community, to our children, of these full-time teachers? They might end up disagreeing with her, which is fine. But they never ask the question of what is the value.
Mm-hmm.
And if they agree to the value, then they should have said, okay, well, we're going to try to find money because this is something worth buying for our community. Like if they wanted stained glass windows. For
right.
They would ask the same questions, but they're not asking that about the school.
Right. And I don't know if all board members necessarily make the link between if you have an excellent education system for your children over the years, that's going to translate to them sticking around for longer. And that translates to dollars for your community after B'nai Mitzvahs. And when that drop off occurs, if you have an excellent program, they're more likely to stick around and be a part of more a part of programs after that critical stage.
I don't know about that. I do know that as a Jewish community, we have a responsibility to give our children an excellent Jewish education.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a value to that, to our Jewish community, whether they stay in that synagogue or not. Whatever they do and the decisions that they will make later in their life, it couldn't hurt to have an excellent Jewish education.
Right, right.
It couldn't hurt. But it's the responsibility of the parents and of the community to provide that for the next generation. And by the way, I don't think that's a new idea that I just made up. I think that every generation, going back to Adam and Eve, tried to teach their children in the best way that they knew how.
Yeah.
And saw it as important. Saw it as important for the lives of their children. I mean, if you believe that Judaism makes your life better, that it helps you through difficult periods in your life, that it enhances joyous periods, if you believe that Judaism has real value to a person in their life, then it's worth an investment. But certainly we have a responsibility to make sure that our children have the best education that they can. And right now, I have to say that what's more important is the bottom line. And a lot of synagogues are honestly struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of synagogues are afraid to ask for what they need. And a lot of synagogues are not selling this idea to their congregants. So if congregants are told, if you pay another $100 a year, we could get a much better Jewish education for your kids. How many people want to do that? I mean, maybe more people would say yes if they really thought this was important. I mean, obviously parents who send their kids to day school are shelling out a lot of money for that because they feel it's important. But it turns out
it's quality.
And it's quality.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out in the congregational school system, which, by the way, educates 90% of all kids who get a Jewish education in this country,
mm-hmm.
90%, there's a lot of sense of this isn't a priority of ours from the parents. There's a lot of sense of this isn't a priority of ours from the synagogue board. There's this, and meanwhile, let me just tell you, Jewish educators are passionate about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly hardworking, and they have both hands tied behind their back as they try to do what they're trying to do. Ultimately, I don't think this is going in the right direction. I think if we had an open and honest conversation and really sold the value of what we're doing, I believe that there would be money follows value.
Right. What would you say are the bright spots? What would you say are the things that you look at in the Jewish education field that make you excited, that you think gives you a little bit more hope for the future of Jewish education?
The future of Jewish education is sort of not the question. Like, do I have hope that the next generation will be Jewish? Do I have hope that the Jewish education can be excellent? I mean, what exactly do you...
Yeah, so I'm looking for, like, if there's specific things that you see that are happening in the field when you talk with people that make you excited for the work that they're doing, or that mm-hmm. things are going in a certain positive direction.
The field is divided up into 100 pieces, and all of them are part of New Cage. Mm-hmm. So I do have a familiarity with what's going on in the field. Let's start with culture. The arts are very strong right now in Jewish education. There are literally, I wish I counted them, I wish I knew the number of musicians, songwriters that there right. are writing songs. But if I had to throw in a number, it would be in the hundreds. Mm. You know, people who are very good musicians, who all their writing is Jewish music. Some of them are traveling musicians who go from town to town. And some of them stay in one community and bring all of that stuff to their own congregations. Some of them are cantors and some of them are singer-songwriters. But they are writing and singing and performing beautiful liturgical and non-liturgical music and bringing that aspect of culture to kids. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Cage did was to bring storytelling from a non-existent thing in this century mm-hmm. to a widespread thing. So we have taught hundreds and hundreds of people how to be storytellers, how to take a story and to tell it. And not just read it out of a book, but really to tell it. By the way, it's an old Jewish tradition of storytelling.
Absolutely.
We have artists. We have visual artists who are doing incredible work. We have people doing silk painting. We have people using art to bring people into the text. All kinds of artists working in the field mm-hmm. teaching children art. So that's just one small area. So we're spreading Jewish culture. Judaism is not just a religion, as you know. It has this other aspect of culture. So one of the things that Jewish educators are doing, or people who see themselves as Jewish educators, is they see themselves as cultural educators, mm-hmm. which doesn't mean not religious, by the way. It just means that they're spreading Jewish culture.
Right.
And to take another aspect, early childhood. Early childhood educators who are not all Jewish are teaching young children and families all over the country in large numbers. So little children are coming in at age 1 or 2 or 3 into a school setting in which they're being infused with Judaism. Mm-hmm. Whether their teachers are Jewish or not, the teachers are learning to teach them about Judaism. So they, you know, they get in the car and they sing children's songs and they read Jewish books through PJ Library, which is one of those things which is exciting about Jewish life today.
Mm-hmm. The access to access Jewish literature and music.
Jewish literature and music, and they learn about the holidays and they learn about Shabbat and they learn all this before they're 5 years old. So they've really been prepared to go into any kind of Jewish schooling. They have learned a tremendous amount in their preschool mm-hmm. classrooms, and those teachers are incredibly badly paid.
Yeah.
Incredibly badly paid. But they are dedicated and, you know, they're constantly staying up, you know, all night to work on, you know, little apples for the kids for Tu B'Shvat or something, you know, trying to make every day special for the kids. One of the exciting things that they're doing is called the outdoor classroom. And they're building outdoor classrooms so that children can explore ecology in the outdoors, which to me is extraordinary, you know, mm-hmm. that people would go to that length. It's not just recess, you know, anymore.
Right, providing that experience.
They're really learning about the importance of ecology and the world around them and nature and how things grow and how to save the planet. So these are amazing things that are going on in the preschool. In Hebrew schools today, if there is an innovation in education of any kind, we immediately bring it into Jewish education. Is that the right thing to do? Not always.
Right.
I remember a long time ago, one of the innovations was to teach whole word English.
Okay.
Teach the kid the whole word. So Jews immediately ran to teach Hebrew through the whole word method, but Hebrew is a phonetic language.
Right.
Doesn't work. So, you know, there are a lot of things today, project-based education and experiential education and all kinds of things going on in the world. And the other thing is the principals and the teachers are going out of their way to make it possible for kids to have a Jewish education. You know, if you have two parents working, it is not easy to get kids someplace after school.
Mm-hmm.
So they're bringing the school to their neighborhood. So they're doing it online. So they're only doing it so many hours a week, and the parent can choose which day of the week to do it. You know, do you know what I'm saying? They're going out of their way to make it possible for people. High school programming has incredibly dedicated people who are trying to deepen the experience. There's a lot of talk now about the importance of relational education throughout the school system. So they're giving up instructional time so the kids can get to know each other, because the research shows the friends are actually very important in terms of Jewish identity.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, you know, teaching them one more thing, they're helping them to get to know each other. They're going on retreats. They're taking them to have experiences together. All this to help them to have a friendship base that's Jewish.
Because if they don't have friends, they are not going to want to come back the next year and be engaged.
But also, you know, one of the things for me, I like to joke and say I'm a grand rabbi, because my bar mitzvah kids now have kids. So I'm a grand rabbi. And one of the things that I am Facebook friends with a lot of my students. And what I love to see is that they're Facebook friends with each other. So my students, because they became friends, they became lifelong friends. And that's amazing. That's important. You know, if we're going to have a Jewish community, we have to have a Jewish community.
Connections, absolutely. Yeah.
I just wanted to say one other thing, and that's about adult education.
Oh, great.
And family education. So to me, one of the most exciting things about Jewish education that I've been involved with is family education. And family education was the idea that it's not really our unique job to teach children about Judaism, but that we're part of a team.
Mm-hmm.
And that team includes the parents, includes the Jewish community at large, in our synagogue and beyond. If we're going to teach children about something, we also have to teach their parents about it. And we have to make it possible for the parents to teach their children about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, it really doesn't mean very much.
You're listening to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Melkin. I want to take a moment to introduce you to my next guest, Derek Klarfeld, the Managing Director for DRG, Executive Search Consultants for the nonprofit sector. We discuss what it's like to help Jewish organizations search for executive-level positions, how the process has changed over time, and for those who are hoping to be in those positions, what things or aspects you should be looking out for. Here's a bit of our conversation.
There's always a problem to solve at the beginning of every search, which is, first we want to know what are the problems in the organization and how can we help the organization to understand and articulate what are those problems and challenges they're trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
So before we even talk about the candidate or the position, we want to know, where do you want this person to take you? If it's a chief development officer, we want to know, what are the goals for the organization around the areas of development? If it's for a CEO, we want to spend a lot of time with the board really understanding what are the goals for the next 3 to 5 years so that the CEO can take you there.
Mm-hmm.
So before we get there, we really have a deep forensic understanding of each of the organizations that we're partnering with and each of the searches. So a good bulk of the work before we even start with anything related to candidates is really about helping the organizations to be self-reflective.
That's our next episode with Derek Klarfeld. And for now, back to Rabbi Sherry Kohler Fox of New Cage. So we also see, obviously, with the rise of interfaith couples, the fact that you're educating the whole family together. You know, you might have one of the parents isn't Jewish, and so they no longer feel excluded from the child's education and from what they're learning as something that they're doing with, you know, that their spouse knows, but that it's something that they're also participating in learning along with the child and feeling like a unit in the learning together.
Right. But, you know, you'd be surprised. A lot of marriages are interfaith marriages. Mm-hmm. You know, you're Orthodox, I'm Reform, you're conservative.
Right. Reform.
We're both conservative, but we grew up in very different households. So every family that comes together really has to make their own sense of what their Jewish family is going to be like. Mm-hmm. I was big into building Sukkot at people's houses instead of at the synagogue because I wanted the kids to really feel like this was their Sukkah. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, they did. And so the parents would come and we would build this sukkah together. And after the first time I did it, I realized something was really wrong. And I asked them, what's really wrong here? And they said, well, we're building this, but we don't know what it looks like when we're finished. So after that, I had every teacher, when they went to a family's house to build a sukkah, that they brought a picture of a sukkah with them. So we would everybody would know what a sukkah looked like. Now, to be fair, it's really a big point because there are no dumb questions. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have run into a sukkah and you might not have run into a sukkah. And yet you want to share that with your child. So good for you. You know, mm-hmm. let's make this something that
accessible.
You don't have to feel like this door is closed to you. Mm-hmm. All doors are open. All questions are important. And for me, no, I was the rabbi at what started out to be the Harvard Hillel Children's School, Congregation Eitz Chaim in Cambridge. So all of my congregants were Harvard professors and, you know, and so I learned that from them. I learned that they knew everything about everything and that they didn't know everything about Judaism. So ask away, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're all going to know everything about everything. But right now, you have to be able to ask questions. And I think a lot of congregations now are seeing the importance of allowing people to ask questions, allowing people to find their way. Mm-hmm. Just to circle back to the question.
Yeah, absolutely.
I believe that there are tremendously exciting things happening in congregational schools today, more than anybody would imagine. If you went to Hebrew school as a kid, this is not your Hebrew school. The people who work in Jewish education today are incredibly passionate, dedicated people trying to do the best that they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That's a wonderful view of the field. Obviously, it has its challenges, but definitely full of a lot of exciting activity going on. Mm-hmm. So what would you say, what advice would you give to our younger professionals, to people who maybe have been in the field for a couple of years or are currently studying for their Jewish education masters or are considering Jewish education as a career?
My favorite question. Thank you for asking.
You're welcome.
I put myself back in your shoes and I come to the same conclusion. You must get to know other people in the field. Mm-hmm. You must get to know people who are Orthodox and conservative and Reform, working with teenagers, working with little children. You must know day schools. You must know people in the field. And the number one reason is because this is not an easy field to be in and you need support. Mm-hmm. When the going gets tough, you need to know who to go to. And it's not just your immediate circle of friends. You need to know, like, if I am looking for a story on, I don't know what, I need to be able to call Panina Shram.
Right.
You know, I need
to. Or if you're dealing with a difficult board and you need to figure out how other people have advocated for teachers or advocated for resources.
And, or if you have to write a teacher's manual, for goodness sake, don't do that.
Right.
You know, get on Facebook and ask your friends who's written a teacher's manual.
Right.
You know, don't spend 20 hours looking for the lyrics to a song when all you have to do is ask and 30 seconds later, someone will send it to you. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to share resources and we have to know each other. And the other thing is don't keep innovation in your own classroom. That is a shame. Take it somewhere where everybody can steal it. From you.
Right. Open source Jewish education.
Open source Jewish education. Absolutely. Because that's how the field grows and progresses. Mm-hmm. So and the importance of research. I think, you know, everybody has their own theories of what makes Jewish education work, but those theories have to be tested. So many of us have our own theories. So we have to be doing self-research. We have to come and share what we're doing with our colleagues and to the scrutiny of our colleagues where we get some feedback for what we're doing. We have to come out of our little silos into a larger field that is not separated by denominations, because everybody teaches the same basic things and we can learn from everybody. And that is what makes it feel better. So right now, NewCage is one of the main places where you can go to meet colleagues from all over the country and the world. Mm-hmm. We have several programs specifically geared for younger educators that are heavily scholarshiped to come. NewCage travels around the country, so it could be relatively near you one year or another.
Right.
So come on out, you know, and take leadership in the field. It's not just about your one job. Because I know that one of the things that's really wrong today is that the job definitions are way bigger than they should be. Mm-hmm. I know how busy people are. I know young educators have young children. And yet, it's really important to have a small amount of volunteer time to think of the larger issue, the macro issue of Jewish education. You're not just working in your little place. You're part of a bigger picture. What is wrong here? You know, the Jewish education is, Jewish community is in a bit of a crisis today. There are places that have an 80% intermarriage rate. That could be a good thing. That could be a bad thing. It depends a lot on how we deal with it, how welcoming we are. But whatever the issues that we're facing, synagogues are getting smaller, nobody's coming to them. You know, how are we going to deal with all these questions? You cannot figure this out in your little, in your individual little world.
So when you say taking on leadership positions, that just means, elaborate a little bit more on that. So I'm a Jewish educator. Maybe I've got two kids. I work full time. But I need a little bit more something, as you mentioned, to break out of the silo of the work that I've been at the same synagogue for 5 years. I do the same programs every year. What are some opportunities? What are some leadership type things that I could be looking for, whether virtually or in person?
You can be involved in bringing new educators into the field. You can be involved in mentoring newer educators. Even at 5 years, you have a lot to teach. You can come to a conference like NewCage. We always ask ourselves the question, what could we do this year at the conference that's going to make Jewish education just a little better? Mm-hmm. You could ask that question. You know, to me, that's an exciting question. What could we do? Last year, an answer that we had was that all of a sudden the calendar was kind of upside down and backwards last year, and there was a whole month to teach Tishrei. Usually, we don't have any time to teach Tishrei. It's
right.
too early in September, and nobody's there. And here we had a full month to teach Tishrei. So we did 20 sessions. I think we may have done 40 sessions on Tishrei. So people had a chance to come and to really learn about all the aspects of Tishrei that they didn't know. Mm-hmm. And then we published all those sessions in an issue of our journal, The Jewish Educator, it's called. So everybody went away and back to their congregations with some new idea about how to teach Tishrei. Hopefully more than one idea. And so the depth of teaching of Tishrei was better this year than the year before. You know, incremental, small steps.
Right. Just kind nothing, of looking for those other opportunities or...
Yeah, nothing changes. But I think also writing about what you're doing is important. That's why we have a journal, and why it's so important to keep doing self-studies and writing and those things that help us move the field forward. And since we started with advocacy, let's just say that unless we stand up for ourselves and for the value of what we're doing, nothing good is going to happen.
Right.
We have to stop just thinking it is the way it is, when if we join together, we can figure out a way to make it better.
Or if you can give examples of what other people are doing, or, you know, saying, well, this synagogue supports their educator in X, Y, or Z, or this many other people I talk to also do this thing. We could do this too. You know, that kind of networking and connection. Well,
yes. And right. Then being an advocate to your synagogue for these ideas that you're willing to go and talk to your board and explain to them, or we're trying to bring lay people to the conference. We want the lay people to see that there's a wide variety of choices.
Absolutely. Yeah. What's the trend been for that, for lay leaders attending this conference?
This is something that we're starting to work on this year. Great. At New Cage. In the past, we've had lay leader days, but what we're really looking for is people like us who are passionate about Jewish education, but the way they play it out is to be the chair of their education committee at their synagogue. Mm-hmm. And we want to bring them into the discussion with us. So I think that's really important. I think it's going to take, you know, the educator saying, hey, why don't you come with me to the conference this year and meet other lay leaders and learn how to navigate the complicated issues that lay leaders face when they're dealing with a congregation.
You're only one person. So there's a, you know, if there's multiple sessions going on, they can say, hey, be my second person to come and learn more and that I can't pick up on.
Right, exactly. So I think that everybody needs support to make this better. The lay leaders need support and education. The parents need support and education. The children need support and education, and the teachers and the educators need support and education. We have to keep upping our game all the time. It's a changing world with changing children. I'm told the kids today are not the way they were once upon a time. How do we teach them from where they're at? Mm-hmm. So we have to spend some time every year talking about that, becoming better. And even professional development that's in your congregation where they bring one expert in and everybody sits around and listens to them. And I've been that person many times. I can tell you that at New Cage, you can choose what you need to know. Mm-hmm. You don't have to sit in a room and hear what everybody else is hearing, which may or may not be relevant to what you are. So here's my commercial for New Cage. I don't mean to do that, but
please.
What we've learned is that New Cage is life-changing. It's not what you can read about. I can show you the program book, but the program book is just the sessions. It doesn't explain what happens to people when they find themselves among colleagues, where they have those late night discussions, where they find themselves reinvigorated by this passion that I've been talking about, where they go back to school kind of ready to do something new and exciting, mm-hmm. and take on something new. I've never been able to describe this to people, but all of the comments that we get are about this. New Cage is life-changing. It changed how I think about what I'm doing. It changed how I experience what I'm doing. Some people come to New Cage from small towns where they're not used to being with 400 or 500 Jewish people.
Right.
Last year, I did a small research project about pluralism. It was recently published. We asked people, was pluralism at New Cage important to you? And the answer was an overwhelming yes. And then what does pluralism mean to you? And what was really interesting about this study was there were 25 definitions of pluralism after I collapsed categories.
Right.
But one of the things that I found interesting was that the ability to explore what other people believe and think. Mm-hmm. In other words, you could cross lines. You didn't have to be limited to your own lines.
And that's the value of being cross-denominational for your organization.
It is.
Not similar thinking.
But there were lots of other reasons. There was like, I myself have one foot in one place and one foot in another. And people are always judging me. And here I'm accepted for who I am as a Jew. If I had the chart in front of me, I could tell you some of the other 25 definitions. But there were lots of views of how important pluralism is, which I believe very strongly in pluralism in the Jewish community, because we're one family and what we have in common is much more important than what divides us.
That's fantastic. Partially the mission of your organization, right? To bring people together and unite people.
That is the mission.
So for you yourself personally, you know, you got a big job. It's a big job that you do. How do you keep balance in your own life? How do you keep grounded when you're planning a you know, conference for 400 or 500 people and traveling, I'm sure you, as you do, speaking mm-hmm. with all these different congregations? What are ways that you stay connected?
Well, I hope all you younger educators are listening to this because I involve my whole family in this. This has become a bit of a family project that we do. My kids came to the conference from the time they were in utero. They grew up at the conference. We had amazing childcare programs once I had children and needed that. And we are ready to do that again for a new generation of kids, because this is really an important way to bring kids into it. In other words, you don't have to leave them behind. Mm-hmm. So if we provide really good childcare, and by really good, I mean, you can have Josh Nelson singing to them and Penina telling them a story, you know, and great artists doing artwork with them, they'll have a great time. One of the things that we did is from a young age, we brought the kids to the conference. And right now, my daughter is the conference coordinator.
It's a great example of bringing up the next generation.
Yeah, and my husband always comes and teaches, and that's one way. And the other way is that, you know, you have to find your Shabbos.
That's a wonderful line. I just want to put that on something. Find your Shabbos. That's
find
great.
Your Shabbos, you know, and find your family time. Like we always go away after the conference. First, we go away and find a place to sleep for 3 or 4 days.
Right.
And then we get up and have a vacation after that. You know, I think that it's important. One of the things that's happened over, I don't even want to do the math.
A number of years.
Over 40 years of Cage and New Cage is we have made so many lifelong friends. And not just me, but Jewish educators have become lifelong friends for each other, and you know, there are groups of them that go off on vacation together. And the other thing is, you know, frankly, Jewish education is a high percentage of women. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of women stuff that goes on for good and for bad.
Right.
So I think that that conversation has also been very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's finding your people, right? You spend yes. your days in a synagogue with parents, and as you mentioned, board members and rabbis, and right. you know, unless you get an opportunity to be around other people that do similar work to what you do in various contexts and learn from each other and be with each other and understand each other, then you're alone. And
you are alone, and you're not going to stay in the field that way. Mm-hmm. It's literally impossible. So yes, we have lots of online ways that we communicate to people, but I will go head to head with the people who tell me that that's enough. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to sit down late at night and have, you know, a beer with somebody or a cup right. of tea, and then you can go online and have important conversations with them. But you have to be able to, you know people and care about them. And one of the things that's very important to me is that we do a whole section every year of Us Girl. People die who've worked in the field. I feel like I need to recognize, you know, and we honor people also who are alive. I feel like honoring people is really important. So there has to be some way that we can honor the important work that we know that we're doing. You know, Jewish educators are literally paying for the Jewish education of kids today. We're paying because we're not making enough money or getting enough benefits for what we do. So we're actually giving part of our parnassa to people who are much wealthier than we are, just because we want the privilege of being able to teach their children. Mm-hmm. You know, we are spending much too much time. You know, we don't just have one job. Very often people have three jobs. They're in charge of the Hebrew school and the high school and the nursery school, and they write for the bulletin, and they, who knows what else.
Right.
They do, right. So they're actually, and every job you add is 8 hours, you know. There's not much self-care in that particular scenario. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to get the job descriptions down to, you know, a normal full-time job, which probably is not 9 to 5, but it isn't, you know, 80 hours a week either.
Yeah, 9 to 9.
No one understands how long it takes to run a school that is only a few hours a week. I get it.
Absolutely.
But we're not telling them. We're not explaining to them like this. So I feel like Jewish educators really need to get a little more political and a little more to stand up for what they need, because they are a precious resource of the Jewish community. I really believe that.
As your life's work has shown. Well, wonderful. Is there any last comments or thoughts you have about your own work or your life or your role or the role of Jewish educators in the Jewish community?
I was 25 years in one congregation. I had the privilege of a board that always said yes to me. Let's do this. Okay.
You're lucky.
Let's do this. Let's learn this. I mean, it's partly luck, but it was also partly a partnership that we developed over time. I had the privilege of seeing generations grow up, and I feel like that was a wonderful thing. I heard someone say once, if you leave every 7 years, you get more money in the end. And I'm sure that's true. I am positive that's true. But I've also, you know, had the privilege to be a rabbi, to bring people from birth to the grave. And that also has been a remarkable privilege. I know from our research, as much as people complain about the time and the money and the lack of benefits, that everybody loves this job because it's never the same on any given day. You might find yourself in a recording studio. You might find yourself cleaning out closets. You might find yourself, you know, holding a crying child or having an insight with a student or a parent. There really are very few jobs that offer the range of tasks and experiences that working in the Jewish community does. So I encourage everybody to come into this field to make it better, but you can't do that by yourself. You have to join together and put your heads together and think of better ways to be Jewish educators in the field, and not just better ways to do Jewish education, but these bigger issues. And I just would urge people, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. We've gotten this in our generation so far. Climb on board. We will teach you and mentor you, and let's take it from here. And maybe the things that we didn't accomplish in our time, you'll be able to accomplish in your time. So that's really my...
That's a wonderful thought, Sherry.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Well, I appreciate your having me, Michelle.
Yeah, of course. Well, best of luck for your conference. It's coming up, I see, August 6th through the 9th. Is that correct?
Yes. This year, we're going to be in San Francisco in a place called Moraga at St. Mary's College, which we're calling... Satmar. That's what Satmar means.
Great. Thank you so much, Eric. Best of luck to you. Thank you for all of your thoughts.
Thank you, Michelle.
There are many things from my conversation with Sherry that I want to bring up in this conclusion. There's a real emphasis that she puts on connecting and sharing with one another. We're called the Jewish community for a reason. And that reaches beyond the local community that we do our work for and into the broader national and international community that we have access to. Sherry touched upon this, and I will inevitably touch upon this in many other episodes, the importance of being able to advocate for yourself. And not just yourself as far as pay or benefits, but yourself as far as the work that you do. You can't have a great school, and you can't have a great relationship with your board or your parents without really learning how to advocate for yourself and what is best for your school. To be able to communicate to those with money or decision-making power the actual value of what it is that you do. And the value of a positive Jewish education goes beyond communicating the reason of the holidays, how to decode Hebrew. What you're teaching are the values that add positivity to our lives and the values that we are teaching our children of how to be a good person in this world. And those values are worth advocating for. Sherry talked about all the really exciting things happening in Jewish education. And New Cage is there to bring Jewish educators together in community and sharing. If you're someone who's attended one of these conferences, maybe it's time to bring a lay leader and show them what a community of Jewish educators is all about and bring them back to your home community, energized and excited and ready to be an advocate on your side. Rabbi Sherry Kohler-Fox and New Cage's information is on our website. It's whoyouknowpodcast.wordpress.com. One last announcement for the podcast is that we have secured a fiscal sponsor, Jewish Creativity International, which will allow us to raise money for this podcast, to upgrade our equipment, do some marketing, possibly get somebody else other than myself to do the editing, and potentially be able to bring you some more episodes. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, our information is on the website. Thank you very much to Bob Goldfarb for being open to this partnership, and we'll be having him on our podcast in a few weeks. Now, go out and find your Shabbos.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowpodcast.wordpress.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.